Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, has it come to this? Apparently, it has. We have Christian groups pleading with Sarah Palin to stop lying and inciting violence. We have a man shot three times because he's wearing an Obama t-shirt. And we have both McCain and Palin rallies whipping up explicit and overt hatred of a man who happens to be half white and half black, Barack Obama. They never mention the half white part for some reason. McCain asked the crowd, "Who is Barack Obama?" Immediately you hear someone yell, "Terrorist!" McCain pauses, the audience laughs, and McCain continues on, not chastising, not acknowledging, not correcting. So at a McCain rally, you've got a guy yelling, "He's a terrorist." McCain is like, you know, this reminds me of when McCain was campaigning earlier and somebody asked him how they were going to stop Hillary Clinton and referred to her with the B word. And McCain said, "That's a pretty good question." This is a little worse, frankly. We have a long history in this country and frankly around the world of actually murdering people for their skin color. There's a lot of women who've been murdered for being women as well. It's a subtly different thing, but this is Sarah Palin down in Florida. She says, "Now it turns out one of Obama's earliest supporters is a man named Bill Ayers." "Boo," says the crowd. "And according to the New York Times, he was a domestic terrorist and part of a group that, quote, launched a campaign of bombings that would target the Pentagon and our U.S. Capitol," she continued. "Boo," the crowd repeated. "Kill him," proposed one man in the audience. "Kill him." Did Palin say anything? No. No, this is apparently the kind of response that these folks are trying to elicit. It's down to this, my friends. You want a drinking game for tonight, by the way. There it is. It's down to this. Racial hatred. That's all they've got to sell. Fear and hate. This is what Republicans have been selling ever since Lee Atwater first got into this game in the first George Herbert Walker Bush campaign with the Willie Horton spots. Fear and racial hate. Oh, and keep the press at bay. Dana Milbank writing in the Washington Post. In Clearwater, arriving reporters, this is for the Palin campaign, arriving reporters were greeted with shouts and taunts by the crowd of 3,000. Hate the press, too. Palin then went on to blame Katie Couric's question for her less-than-successful interview with kind of mainstream media. At that point, Palin supporters turned on reporters. I'm quoting Dana Milbank. He was there. Turned on reporters in the press area, waving thundersticks and shouting applause, or excuse me, shouting abuse. Others hurled obscenities at a camera crew. One Palin supporter shouted a racial epithet at an African-American sound man for a network and told him, "Sit down, boy." ABC's Jake Tapper says, "Getting ugly out there." Well, apparently it is. Juby Aguado was buying a mobile telephone top-off card in an off-license. This was in London when a gunman confronted him and glared at his T-shirt, which carries an image of the Democratic U.S. presidential candidate, Barack Obama, underneath the legend, Believe. This is from the Daily Mail today. The man then launched into a tirade. This is inside the store. Launched into a tirade of racist slurs and shouting, I effing hate ends, and urging 36-year-old Mr. Eguatu to leave the shop with him. Mr. Eguatu stayed in the store. The man left the shop, but when Mr. Eguatu reemerged, the attacker was waiting for him in broad daylight with a threatening-looking dog and holding a gun behind his back. The terrified Mr. Eguatu zipped up his jacket to cover the image of Mr. Obama and walked to his car. But the shaven-headed man, who was white, followed Mr. Eguatu and, after pulling open the passenger door, pointed the gun at him. After pleading with the man to leave him alone, the married former street warden put the keys in the ignition and turned the engine on. The attacker then fired the gas-powered ball-bearing pistol three times, hitting the servant in the face, hand, and shoulder. Fearing for his life and bleeding heavily, Mr. Eguatu raced away in his car, found somewhere safe to call for help. He was taken to hospital and later sent to have a piece of metal removed from his jaw. I couldn't believe it was happening, he said, and just because I was wearing an Obama T-shirt. He was trying to make me walk someplace quieter, saying, I've got something for you, and I'm going to kill you. I got a note from a listener who says it so eloquently that rather than trying to, I'll just give you a few quotes. When Karl Rove used whispering campaign techniques and a black love child rumor against McCain in 2000, I was absolutely disgusted. But at the end of the day, while it may have indeed cost him South Carolina and consequently the nomination, it would bring no immediate harm to Senator McCain's life and no potential for danger to it. When Bush and company allowed the Swiftboat vets to have at it with questioning Kerry's patriotism in 2004, although extremely annoying, and Senator Kerry's ego may have been bruised, again, his life and well-being may never have been in any immediate danger. But now, here we have a presidential campaign inferring the United States senator is connected with the same people who want to destroy us. They have allowed chants like kill him, and he is a terrorist, to go unchecked at their rallies, and by default could be accused of encouraging them. This behavior is not only careless, it's also reckless and extremely dangerous. And I might add, I believe it's against the law. Regardless of your stance or how many, my correspondent, our listener writes in, he says, regardless of your stance or how you may feel about Senator Obama, I plead with you actually, closer to begging you to call to task this disgusting tactic of inciting hatred and raging fear that the GOP has resorted to using. Meanwhile, at the Christian Voice website, crossleft.org, an open letter submitted by Stephen Rockwell Monday. Dear Governor Palin, as fellow Christians, we ask you to stop bearing false witness against your brother, Barack Obama. You recently made the insidious claim that Senator Obama was palling around with terrorists. All unbiased observers have noted that the claim is patently false. We, the undersigned, ask you to stop these false attacks and rather to raise the level of discourse to discuss the issues that matter most to Americans, the economy, the environment, education, health care, the war. As Christians, we must remember that Jesus told us to love our neighbors and, more importantly, our adversaries as ourselves. Your recent stump speeches enter territory that not only adversely affect our civil discourse as a nation, but diverge from basic biblical teaching. The Ten Commandments states the case clearly. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Proverbs 6:16-19. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run into evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Jesus affirms in Matthew 19:18, reiterating his commitment to the Ten Commandments, you shall not bear false witness. And since Obama is one of us as Christians and as an American, Obama does think like us. We believe that each of the candidates, Barack Obama and John McCain, have the best interests of the country in their hearts and minds. We call upon you to issue a retraction and an apology and to refrain from further instances of bearing false witness against your brother, Barack Obama. This is a woman who is going after Barack Obama, using words like terrorist and hating America, when her husband hates America so much that he was a member of the Alaska Independence Party that encourages separation from America. And her former pastor, the guy who laid hands on her to cast out witchcraft, is a terrorist who has pursued women across Kenya as witches. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And dare to say, no, don't think so. Back to the actual issues. Go over to KeatingEconomics.com. This little 13-minute video narrated by William Black, Ph.D., the former federal banking regulator from 84 and 85, about Mr. McCain's behavior in the as one of the Keating Five, trying to stop the banking regulators, actually successfully over a short period of time, stopping the banking regulators from stopping Charles Keating from looting his bank of hundreds of millions of dollars. Amazing. It's amazing. One of the questions that I am so hoping gets raised tonight, and I hope Obama takes the gloves off tonight. He had several opportunities in the last debate to point out McCain's record, particularly on veterans affairs, and he didn't take them. He decided that he was going to be presidential, he was going to stay above it, he was going to be the good guy, and maybe he'll do the same tonight, and maybe it's the best strategy. Frankly, I am astounded by how effectively this has worked for Barack Obama through the primaries and now in the main election. But John McCain has reconfigured his health care plan once again. Used to be, up until a few weeks ago, he was saying, you know, the plan is to cause you to, the average health insurance cost in the United States right now per family is around $12,000. And typically about half of it is paid for by the employee and half of it by the employer. And McCain was going to make that 100% taxable. So all of a sudden you've got $12,000 of additional taxable income, or at least $6,000 in yours, and your employer has $6,000 in theirs to pay income taxes on. So he scaled that back a little bit. He's limiting that. And instead he's saying, well, we need to raise some money someplace. Let's cut $1.3 trillion. That's with a T, trillion. That's $1.3 trillion out of Medicare and Medicaid. That's 1,300 million dollars. It's $1 million 1,300 million times. Excuse me, it's $1, 1,300 million times. And, you know, like this is going to play really well in Florida, for example? I don't get it. I'm totally baffled. And at the same time, you got Sarah Palin out there talking about Obama, you know, he served on the board of a nonprofit in Chicago with Bill Ayers, a former terrorist, when Barack Obama was 8 years old, and Barack Obama has condemned him in that behavior, by the way. But I don't hear her condemning Joe Vogler, the guy who founded the Alaska Independence Party that her husband was a member of up until 2002, an actual member of her husband. Can you imagine if Michelle Obama had been a member of, say, the Black Panthers, which never, by the way, advocated secession from the United States? But Mr. Vogler...
The fires they hail are frozen glaciers compared to my hatred for the American government. And I won't be buried under their damn flag. I'll be buried in Dawson. And when Alaska is an independent nation, they can bring my bones home, back to my country.
And she recorded the, hey, great to have you here for the annual meeting in 2008 video for them, for their 2008 meeting. And her husband was a member up until 2000. And she has the audacity to talk about people who don't love America? This is on a couple of different websites. I found it over at Huffington Post. I'm not sure where it originated. Maybe one of our folks in our chat room will know, and we can give a shout out to them. The Sarah Palin debate in the VP debate in 30 seconds.
In these waning days of the Bush administration, I'm going to talk straight to the American people. There have been huge blunders. It's a toxic mess, a stinking corpse. I don't want to argue about the causes. That's not patriotic. The chant is Maverick. What do you expect? A team of Mavericks. Joe Sixpack, hockey moms. We do have a good plan. Nuclear weaponry, of course. Nuclear weapons. How long have I been at this? Like 5 weeks? It's going to be okay. You get extra credit for watching this debate.
This is George Bush wearing lipstick. The thing that struck me, and pretty weird about this, at the very ending, you get extra credit for this debate. And somebody pointed out in the, I believe it was in the chat room, might have been a caller last week, that Sarah Palin, the way that she dresses and presents herself, bears a spooky resemblance to the naughty teacher stereotype from porn films in the 80s and 90s. And at the very end...
It's going to be okay. You get extra credit for watching this debate.
And we've got all these conservatives, you know, Rich Lowry out there talking about how he gets erect on the couch watching Sarah Palin. He thinks she's winking at him. I mean, there's strange stuff going on the Republican side. Just downright strange stuff. Tim Dickinson is going to drop by from Rolling Stone, tell us about who is the real John McCain. In our second hour, Bruce Fein, columnist for the Washington Times, part of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He's got a new book about constitutional peril. And Marjorie Cohen in our third hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to teamster.org for more information. Tim Dickinson is with us, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, rollingstone.com. This is a brilliant story. Tim, first of all, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for joining us from San Francisco. And by the way, I saw this online. I haven't seen the magazine itself yet. Is this the cover story?
Yes, it is.
Great. This is absolutely brilliant. Make-believe Maverick, a closer look at the life and career of John McCain, reveals a disturbing record of recklessness and dishonesty. Pick up a copy of Rolling Stone at your local newsstand. I'm assuming it's the one that's out now?
Yeah, it should. I think it's just hit the newsstand.
It's just hitting the newsstand. Great. And of course, you can see it also on the web at rollingstone.com. Tim, the opening of this piece, I mean, there's a lot of very disturbing things in this article, but the opening of it really is a beautiful frame, just a brilliant way to establish this thing. Tell us this story very quickly.
It's a meeting between John McCain and a fellow former POW guy named John Dramisi.
This was in 1974.
This is in 1974 at Fort McNair, where they were both studying and preparing to go abroad on the government dime to sort of meet and powwow with foreign government leaders. McCain and Dramisi shared this experience of Vietnam, but whereas McCain was, I think you could say, sort of an average POW, I think he didn't really distinguish himself. He wasn't one who was, his experience was, as I was told by several people, fundamentally average for the POWs. But Dramisi was a guy who had attempted two escapes and for one attempt was tortured for 38 days or something. But had never participated in the North Vietnamese propaganda efforts. And so he was the recipient of two Air Force crosses, which are, one of the highest medals that you can receive in that service. And so, there's sort of this awkward chit-chat between these two guys, I think, that in part because...
Well, let's just add here that McCain had not only made a confession, he did over 30 propaganda tapes for the North Vietnamese, and his own voice was broadcast in the POW camp where he and this guy were both, saying, yes, we bombed hospitals, yes, we were war criminals and things like that.
I don't know, you seem to have more specifics about that than I do.
That part is not in your, you reference that in your story.
Right, it's clear that, it's clear that John McCain under torture and participated in these efforts, which was, I'm sure I would have done the same thing. But I'm not running for president as someone who's, claiming himself a war hero. So I guess the point is of the story is that if one of these guys is a hero, it's this guy Dramisi, who lived up to the army's, the military's code of conduct, which demanded that you try and escape, which demanded that you not participate in any of these efforts. And McCain, under torture did. And so not to judge him on that, but to say that there's sort of a gap between these two men in terms of their fundamental conduct. But so McCain and Dramisi are chit-chatting in the courtyard of Fort McNair, and the subject of where they're going on their student travels comes up, and Dramisi says, well, I'm going to the Middle East. I'm going to go to Iran and Lebanon. And McCain says, well, why are you going to the Middle East? And he says, well, John, it's a place where we might have some trouble soon. And he says, well, John, where are you going? And John McCain says, well, I'm going to Rio. And he says, why the hell are you going to Rio? And John McCain, who at this point is a married father of three, says, I got a better chance of getting laid. Right. And the point of the story
and he
is
did, that, in fact, and his mistress has now recently been found.
So the point of the story is that, and Dramisi makes this point, is that, John McCain says he sort of was steeled in the fires of Hanoi, essentially, that he went to Vietnam, a young and callow, fighter jock, and came out, this serious man of patriotism and purpose. But if you sort of examine the sweep of John McCain's, life, it's very hard to discern the contours of that transformation. It really, there's very little to support this idea that the man that came out of Vietnam was fundamentally different from the callow and selfish and oftentimes petulant, man who went in. And so I think in terms of what we watched at the Republican National Convention, we were sold a bill of goods about this man. I think that there's, just a fundamental dishonesty about who he is and some very bizarre distortions of his record. I mean, it's delicate subject matter, and my point is not to demean John McCain's service. I certainly respect the fact that he was raised in a military culture, and this is what he decided to do, was to become a pilot. In Vietnam, torture ended in these camps in 1969 after Ho Chi Minh died. So And if you read John McCain's account of his own experience there, his memoir, he's very clear about that. And so all the POW, you know, the two POWs I spoke to also confirm this idea that, you know, it certainly wasn't a day at the beach afterwards, but what we would all sort of recognize as torture ended in 1969. But at the convention, you know, Fred Thompson said that this went on for 5.5 years, which is just not true. You know, so it's a very bizarre lily to gild. You know what I'm saying? Here was a man who did suffer greatly over the course of about 2 years. But why you need to tell the American public that went on for 5.5? It's just strange to me.
We're talking with Tim Dickinson. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and the author of the current issue's cover story, Make Believe Maverick. You say this is the story of the real John McCain, the one who's been hiding in plain sight. It is the story of a man who has consistently put his own advancement above all else, a man willing to say and do anything to achieve his ultimate ambition to become commander-in-chief, and that this is the position that finally positions him above his father and grandfather, John Sidney McCain III, we should note this kind of lineage. What are some of the things, Tim Dickinson, that John McCain has said or done that are consistent with Mr. Germisi's observation that he's still the undisciplined, spoiled brat that he was when he went into the military?
Well, so, you know, there was a funny story. I mean, and again, a lot of John McCain sort of likes to paint himself as this sort of lovable rascal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if he were just going to be your uncle, that might be true. You know, this is a guy who has some, you know, crazy stories of misbehavior to tell. But if you look at this in the context of, is this a man that has the self-control and the discipline to be president, I think you, everything that my research has led me to, it's a resounding no. But here's just a case of just sort of simple, puerile mischief, right? So he's in Saudi Arabia. He's the liaison to the Navy's liaison to the Senate. And so he's traveling around the world with senators, on these diplomatic missions. And so he's on one trip. He's with John Tower, the former Texas senator, mm-hmm. And he's John Tower is a big drinker, and they're going to Saudi Arabia where liquor is outlawed. And so John McCain not only smuggles liquor into Saudi Arabia for John Tower, which is I'm not sure how that would, you know, it's not well known, but I'm not sure how the Saudis would react to that right now. But and then there are some French tourists who are checking in, and somehow they rub John McCain the wrong way. And John McCain at this point is in his mid-30s. He's just, you know, and he's supposed to be the Navy's liaison, somebody who's supposed to be, you know, upholding the standards of the Navy
and representing our country.
And representing our country there. And so these tourists sort of rub him the wrong way, and so John Tower finishes his Johnny Walker Black, and I guess there's these little mini airplane bottles that he's got,
mm.
And so John McCain takes note of where the French tourists are staying, and he on his way out litters the, you know, empty bottles on their room service tray in an attempt to get them in trouble with the authorities.
Mm.
You know, it's just this is not. It's a small, and McCain, you know, in his memoir tells us this sort of great, you know, oh, I didn't like these tourists, and, you know, but it's a small thing, you know, I mean, but there are many more, you know, I mean, he was just atrocious in his behavior towards his first wife, who, mm-hmm. You know, if the measure of heroism is the amount of suffering that someone's been through, you know, she was in the hospital for 6 months after a terrible car crash. That took, you know, I think 5 inches off of her height, and she had 23 surgeries, and you know, was really disabled by this crash. And yet, you know, when John McCain came back, he sort of seemed determined to catch up on the free love that he had missed out on in the late 60s there, because he would be flying back and forth. He was stationed at Jacksonville, and on these cross country flights would seduce fellow members of the Navy, you know, and it was even widely linked to his subordinates, you know, not only.
Do you think that the recent stories of his having an affair within the last year with this lobbyist, where his staff eventually had to bar her from the plane, were credible?
You know, I don't have any information on that, and I think the case of Vicky Eisenman is actually less interesting as a love story and more interesting as a tale of corruption, because here is a lobbyist who clearly had top level access to John McCain, and had her clients arrange meetings for her clients and got John McCain to write letters to the FCC on their behalf when John McCain was the chairperson of the Senate Commerce Committee, and William Kennard, the chairman of the FCC, sternly rebuked John McCain for meddling in the FCC's process by writing these letters. But nonetheless, the FCC, responded very quickly to John McCain's inquiries and ruled in favor of this guy who was, donating lots of money and then even offering John McCain the use of his private jet for campaign events.
Yeah, not unlike Mr. Keating, only last year.
This was in 2000, but
or in 2000, okay.
You know, but it goes to the point that the Keating affair was supposed to have transformed McCain too, but there's very little evidence.
And it didn't.
That.
Tim, we're out of time. RollingStone.com. Tim Dickinson, thank you so much, Tim.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Minutes past the hour, or before the hour, rather. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Richard Fuld, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, going before Congress saying, I just had to have my $300 million. I'm sorry, everything's fine. Yeah. What isn't noted here is, in other words, even as this from the story, I believe this is from the New York Times. Executives who feared for their bonuses in the company's last months were told not to worry, even as Lehman pleaded for a federal bailout. What the article doesn't note is who was saying not to worry. The person who was saying not to worry was George Herbert Walker, an executive at Lehman Brothers and cousin of George Walker Bush. If that's not bizarre, I don't know what is. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, Tom in North Hollywood. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. Tom, I have voted in the past for some Republicans, and actually after yesterday hearing at McCain's rally where he mentioned Barack's name and someone yelled out terrorist, and at Sarah Palin's rally, someone yelling out kill him, it urged me to it made me call every Republican senator and also to call the McCain campaign at 703-418-2008 and tell them how disgusted I am with them. I'm a Christian guy, and I don't believe that things like that. I just think that's way over the line. I couldn't take it. I am voting for Barack Obama this time. I just think that hearing these people or hearing, people that I feel, Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater would not approve of that type of, language and that type of vitriol out there, that they have lost me. And like I said, I would recommend for any other Republican people out there or Republican voters out there to call their state senator. To put pressure on, this is not the type of party that we are, and also to call the McCain campaign and tell them that this is not the campaign that we want. Like you always say every day, Tom, get involved, do the things that you need to do,
Tom, let me encourage you to show up at the Republican headquarters and volunteer to become part of the Republican Party. I mean, we need good Republicans to take back that party. It's a good thing to have at least a two-party system, to have a loyal opposition, you know, to have both sides of issues discussed. It's just that the crazies have taken over your party.
Well, absolutely, and that's why, like I said, I called all the different state senators this morning to put that pressure on them. So I've called the McCain campaign, put pressure on them, that this is not the party that it once was. This is not who we are, and we don't say things like terrorist, and we don't say things like kill him. That's just way over the line. And like I said, that's not the tenets of Christianity, and that's not the way that I was brought up or believed.
It's not American politics.
Absolutely. And there's a separation between church and state, and I understand that. But when they start using words like kill, which, the commandments is thou shalt not kill, on and on.
Tom, thank you very much for sharing that with us and for taking it to heart and for doing the right thing. Good on you. Congratulations. Ron in Miami, Florida. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
Great. What's up?
Good. I'm a Black Baptist, Southern Baptist minister, and I've seen firsthand the hypocrisy of the conservatives. And when they do the smear campaign, I just want to cite one example. When Jesse Jackson ran for president, they went out and enlisted the help of Eldridge Cleaver and a man by the name, his last name was Brian. He had hijacked a plane to Cuba and Castro threw him in jail. And they flew them around the country. They even came to our church to refute everything that Jesse Jackson was saying and say that he was a communist. So they associated themselves with ex-Black Panthers just to get their point across. But they want to smear everyone else who might be a neighbor or have any conversation or association with anyone that they think will start a culture war.
Yeah. Yeah, that you're absolutely right, Ron. This is what happens, as John McCain pointed out in 2000. This is what you do when you can't talk about the issues. This is what you do when you've got nothing left, is you go after a person's personality, you go after their race, you go after their friends, you go after anything you can other than the issues, because, you know, they got nothing. The Republicans have nothing. I mean, the whole ideology that has been driving the Republican Party since Ronald Reagan took office is disintegrating around us as we look around. Here's you got John McCain suggesting that we should cut $1.3 trillion out of Medicare and Medicaid so that start taxing people's health care benefits. Like, this is somehow going to fix the health care system. For example, I mean, they've got nothing on the real issues, the things America cares about, from the war to the economy to health care to labor issues. They got nothing. So what are they doing? They're trying to invoke race. They're trying to invoke religion. They're trying, you know, God, gays, guns, and blacks, I guess. This is the new, you know, and it's as an American, it's tragic, Ron. Ron, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Bruce Fine coming up next, the Republican columnist for the Washington Times. He's got a new book out that I think you're going to want to know about. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, tonight's going to be a very important conversation. And let's hope that it doesn't descend into the banal and the trivial as so much of this campaign seems to be. There are some really, really serious issues here. Not the least of which is the survival of our constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. Judge Learned Hand, quoted in Bruce Fine's new book, Constitutional Peril. What do we mean when we say that first of all we seek liberty? I often wonder whether we do not rest our hopes too much upon constitutions, upon laws, and upon courts. These are false hopes. Believe me, these are false hopes. Liberty lies in the hearts and minds of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. No constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help it. Bruce Fine, former, as I recall, former Deputy Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice in the administration of Ronald Reagan, General Counsel to the FCC, an attorney who specializes in constitutional and international law, and his new book, Constitutional Peril, the life and death struggle for our Constitution and democracy. Bruce Fine, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom.
It is always fascinating and illuminating to talk with you. As a genuine conservative, as somebody who loves this country, I have to say, sir, I have tremendous respect for you and your perspectives. Even though I'm sure we could come up with a list of things that we disagree about, this is not one of them. This book that you have written is absolutely brilliant. You start out the book talking about the parallels, or invoking the parallels, let's say, between the Roman Republic with Julius Caesar and today.
Yes, I do, because it's the same flaw in the spirit of the culture that caused the destruction of the Republic in the time of ancient Rome, and the same flaw that I detect at present. And you put it well, Tom, in the opening discussing Learned Hand, because ultimately words can do so much. If the American people don't care about self-government, if they don't care about knowing what their government is doing and holding it accountable, if they don't care whether or not Bush says, I'm the president, I can flout any law because I'm claiming that after 9/11 we are confronting a danger worse than the Nazis and the Red Army and the Japanese and Mussolini combined, if they don't care, I can guarantee you liberty has got a very short shelf life. And I am very fearful that we are approaching that precipice, and you've explained correctly that the current campaign, the banality, the gibberish, you know, the airhead comments that go for serious political discourse is utterly alarming.
Yeah, it is. It's troubling to me. It's troubling to my listeners and my readers. I'm sure it is to yours as well. We're talking with Bruce Fine. He's written a brilliant new book, Constitutional Peril. And you go through how basically in this book how basically the Bush-Cheney administration has systematically eviscerated, deconstructed, and gutted our Constitution. And there's been, frankly, very little outcry. And I would say that the average American has no idea.
I think they've been quite passive. The outcry has been non-existent, not only the American people, but largely in Congress as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the American culture does not celebrate self-government anymore. It needs to change. The American culture does not celebrate accountability by the president. And I think, even though I'm reluctant to say this, in large measure, the known victims of the lawlessness at present have been people whose names are hard to pronounce, Boumediene, Hamdan, Al-Mari, Al-Masri. It's just like the Japanese Americans in World War II who are put in concentration camps, Korematsu, Hirabayashi. It doesn't sound like Smith and Jones yet, like in the Nixon administration. Mm. So people think, oh, it's not going to happen to me. Who cares if they spy on you illegally, if you don't have anything to hide that's illegal? We don't care anymore. And indeed, I suppose the high watermark of this chilly callousness towards individual rights was Sarah Palin's comment in her acceptance speech with regard to the vice presidential nomination. Oh, you people are worrying about, you know, protecting individual rights. Well, they're plotting crimes. Well, how do you know that they're plotting crimes until you have a trial, until you have due process?
Right.
And I've just filed a brief, Tom, it concerns 17 who are being held at Guantanamo Bay. Most of your listeners wouldn't know they were Uyghurs. Who are Uyghurs? They're Chinese Muslims in East Turkestan. They had been held 6 years without a single opportunity for a hearing for a court. Finally, when the Supreme Court said, no, you have a constitutional right to habeas corpus, then suddenly last week the government says, okay, we don't really have any evidence that you're an enemy combatant. You've been able to rot 6 years unjustly. You know, now leave us and go away. That's the United States of America. It sounded to me like the Soviet Union that I was reading about in my youth, that Alexander Solzhenitsyn got so Nobel Prizes for. And that's where we've come.
Bruce Fine, his new book, Constitutional Peril, is just out. You were a deputy attorney general in the Justice Department under Reagan. I'm old enough to remember that back in the 50s and 60s, we pretty aggressively taught civics in elementary school and junior high school. In second, third grade, I was memorizing the preamble to the Constitution and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And certainly by the time I got out of elementary school, sixth grade, I understood three branches of government, separations of power, balance of power, all those the fundamental issues. And it was during the 80s that the David Horowitz types launched an all-out assault against public school teachers, suggesting that because they were members of the unions, they were communists, and that they were teaching communism in the schools by teaching things like the history of the labor movement. And basically, we, as a consequence of this, and this is still going on in the colleges, David Horowitz is carrying on this campaign in college campuses, we basically don't teach civics or history or even constitutional law in an appropriate context for a 12-year-old. We don't teach that in our schools anymore.
No.
And you combine that with the fact that we're entertaining ourselves to death, with the amount of television that we watch, and it's very easy, I think, for some of us to start sounding like curmudgeons, back in my day, we actually knew what was going on. These young whippersnappers. But there is a real risk here. There is a real threat here. How do we unwind this, Bruce Fine?
Well, you have the kernel of the problem at hand. Thomas Jefferson warned at the outset of the Constitution that no nation can remain free and ignorant. You can't be free and ignorant at the same time. Constitutions aren't self-executing, and really what we need to do is educate the public to say you have to hold your elected officials accountable. You have to tell a member of Congress you're not going to vote for them unless the congressman insists that he decide, not the president, whether to authorize war. Congress has forfeited its clear constitutional obligation to place on itself the responsibility for going to war or not, because the president has a conflict of interest. He contrives all sorts of fears and dangers, because when war comes, what happens to the president gets more powerful.
He
gets,
as James Madison pointed out.
He gets the heroism. He gets the footprints in the sand of time. That's why, President Bush manufactured this idea that al-Qaeda is like the Red Army and they've got the equivalent of 20,000 ICBM and with nuclear warheads on them and all these other ridiculous things. Instead of treating them as criminals like we had done successfully, we now have a system where we're at perpetual warfare. And I underscore that, Tom, no other time in history have we been in it. Perpetual warfare by definition, because you can never eliminate the risk of an international terrorist incident to zero. And that also means that for the first time in history, the battlefield is everywhere. He can use military force, the president can, anywhere he says he wants to, because he says al-Qaeda could end up in your front door or, in your backyard, and therefore we can impose martial law anywhere. These are truly staggering theories of power that even King George III shied from. And this is not saying an exaggeration. These are the facts. And the American people and Congress sort of shrug their shoulders in large measure because we've become, rather lazy, if you will, on the necessity of an aroused public to be the true custodians and stewards of our democracy.
Right, which is why you were calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush. As James Madison said, no nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
That is correct. And that's what we're encountering now. And you just see it. For instance, the president's claim that's not been repudiated by Congress that if I'm trying to collect foreign intelligence, I can spy on Americans, I can break and enter their homes, I can kidnap them, I can torture them, I can do waterboarding with impunity. That is a truly chilling vision of the United States, again, that reminds me of the Soviet Union under Stalin.
Yeah, I wasn't there under Stalin, but I was in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union and East Germany when it was East Germany, and I'm telling you, we don't want to go there. Bruce Fine, brilliant new book, Constitutional Peril. Buy it. Read it. Bruce Fine, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom. Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You
Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Greg Palast is with us, the investigative journalist, one of the finest investigative journalists working today, and author. GregPalast.com, his website, some of his bestsellers, Armed Madhouse and The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And, hey, Greg, P-A-L-A-S-T.com, check out his website. But stealbackyourvote.org is the website du jour. Greg, welcome to the show.
Yeah, glad to be with you, Tom, in these times. Sorry about your Lehman stock. Anyway,
Hey, did you know anything about the rumor? I heard that after Full testified before Congress about why he just had to take that $30 million as they were going down the tubes. He went back. He was working out in the Lehman Brothers gym, and some guy who worked there went up to him, punched him in the face, and knocked him unconscious.
I have
seen that on a half a dozen sites now. I haven't seen it in any of the corporate media, though. I don't know if it's vanishing hitchhiker story.
It was Ben Bernanke, actually.
Ben Bernanke. Right.
Yeah. So what's happened just in the middle of this crisis? We have another, which is that we are facing our democracy is heading the way of Lehman stock.
Yep.
As you know, many people know that Bobby Kennedy wrote the masterful article in Rolling Stone about the theft of 2004. I exposed a story about in 2000 how Catherine Harris knocked off thousands of black folk, calling them felons. Their only crime was voting while black. So Bobby Kennedy and I, decide to team up and investigate if they're going to steal 2008. And
it's already well underway.
Well, actually, Tom, don't worry. They're not going to steal it, actually, is our conclusion. They've already stolen it. And since they've already stolen it, we've decided to do what you have to do in a democracy crisis. And so we wrote a comic book, an investigative comic book called Steal Back Your Vote. And today we are launching it, sponsored by the astonishing Tom Hartman, because actually you gave us the idea with your graphic writing. So that's how we stole it.
My book, We the People.
Yeah, right. We the People. Yeah. And so you don't get any royalties, but your name is big. It's going to be big on the new editions of Steal Back Your Vote, which you can get at Steal Back Your Vote. Download it, stealbackyourvote.org, or even get print copies, 24 pages, full color, really investigative reporting by Kennedy and I. We just thought we would put it in a form that would give it some clunk and clout. And by the way, it's the penmen on this are Ted Rall, Lloyd Dangle of Troubletown, and Lucas Kettner. It's a top shelf comic. It's a real like comic.
Some real pros,
comic.
And you can download it for a penny. But hey, give a few bucks at stealbackyourvote.org.
Stealbackyourvote.org.
And Greg, we just have a couple minutes left here. What has been stolen, and how do we steal it back?
Well, let me give you an example. In the state of Colorado, the ultimate swing state, that's what's coming down to, Colorado and New Mexico.
Yep.
In Colorado, the Republican secretaries of state have knocked off 19.4% of the names on the voter rolls. That's 1 in 5 voters. By the way, the Democratic Party was completely unaware of that. It's a Democratic governor. They didn't know. They went, oh, my, and because they thought they were going to win it because of the convention in Denver, et cetera. And by the way, I flew there for BBC television and for Rolling Stone with Bobby Kennedy. Standing outside the Secretary of State's door, they refused to speak to me. They refused to go on camera and explain why 1 in 5 voters had to be flushed. Okay,
is this that's a Republican Secretary of State?
Republican Secretary of State. So
in a state with a Democratic governor.
By the way, there's a section in our book. Now, listen, dig this. The Republican Secretary of State who kicked it off, Danetta Davidson, while the Democrats didn't notice, George Bush did, he named her chairwoman of the United States Elections Assistance Commission, where she could teach everyone else how to purge. In fact, he was going to call her the purge in general, but Rove said that's a little much.
So we're on the air in a couple of stations in Colorado. What do people do to get their steal back their votes?
Okay, get the Steal Back Your Vote guide at stealbackyourvote.org. But then one of the steps we say is check your registration, make sure you are registered. That's very important. If you're not registered, go into to try to re-register. If you can't do that, scream about how they purged you, and then go in and vote early. Do not mail in a ballot, because if you've been purged, it's flushed. This is true of all the states. Mass purging everywhere.
Show up so that if you've been purged, you find out right there then on the spot.
Early. Don't wait for election.
But what happens if you show up to vote and it's past the voter registration deadline and they say, we have no record of you being registered? You're just SOL, aren't you?
They're going to have you somewhere on a list. In other words, when they purge you, they don't erase you. Your name will be like inactive voter, felon voter, a mismatched name, something like that. So you can appeal it. Now, what they're going to try to do is give you a provisional ballot. By the
also
way,
known as a placebo ballot.
A placebo bouncing baloney ballot called a provisional ballot. They gave out 3 million last time. 3 million. 1 million were thrown in the garbage. We tell people do not accept the provisional ballot. Demand a real ballot. And we have 800 numbers in the comic book, in the Steal Back Your Vote comic book, for you to call at the early voting station so we can rush lawyers right to you, work and rock the vote and others. And so you can only do this, really, if you vote early. We're really pushing early voting.
Right.
No mail-in, stealbackyourvote.org.
You said it. You said it brilliantly. Greg Palast, gregpalast.com, of course. StealBackYourVote.org, the website, and download the comic and read it and share it with all your friends and get everybody over to this website, StealBackYourVote.org. Thanks, Greg.
Got it.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio, 34 minutes past the hour, and congratulations to Katie. I don't know if she wants her last name used here, so I won't, but she sent a note saying, you've inspired me so much that I'm going to be a poll worker on Election Day. You said yesterday that they have a shortage of poll workers. It's because you have to work from 5:30 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night for $200. But I'm not doing it for the money, but because I want to be there and keep an eye on things. Good on you, Katie. I'm going to send you a copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, which came out last year and basically predicted what's going on right now and talks about what we can do in the face of this kind of an economic crisis. I'm going to send you a copy of my book, Screwed, as our Patriot of the Day. So please send me an email back with your address so I can get it right out to you. Meanwhile, this is from the wire services. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin went on the attack today, claiming the Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama has long-standing ties to the Weather Channel. What does it say about our opponent that he thinks this nation's weather is so imperfect that he needs to be allied with the Weather Channel? She asked a crowd in Tampa, Florida. There's a fine line between hating America's weather and hating America herself. Governor Palin said that she learned about Senator Obama's tie to the Weather Channel last week when I was trying to read the New York Times. They said Senator Obama was hanging out with weathermen, she said. Do we really want to elect someone who's been palling around with meteorologists? Governor Palin's latest attacks came on the heels of a new poll showing that the only demographic group that still supports her are morons, sometimes referred to by political insiders as no-information voters or undecided voters. It may sound like she's spouting idiocy, said Tracy Klugian, a Republican strategist, but there's a method to her madness. She's speaking to her base. Elsewhere, Senator John McCain's practice session for the second presidential debate was cut short when his pants burst into flame. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com, for that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, Dave in Issaquah, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
This is Dave in Issaquah. Say, relevant to what you were just saying and talking about with Greg Palast, I was wondering, given what we saw in Ohio in 2004 and even in Florida in 2000, if it would be helpful for the Obama campaign to start putting out information or making appearances with the press to talk about their concern about the election being stolen and making a statement that if Barack Obama is elected, that he will prosecute fully any officials who have interfered with the vote or tried to suppress voting. just to put people on notice that if he wins and they've been found guilty of doing this, that they will go to jail.
I personally, Dave, I agree with you, and I think it's a good strategy, but here's the problem. The Democratic Party has come to the conclusion that talking about election fraud, the Republicans are out there talking about voter fraud hysterically. You know, oh, there might be somebody from Mexico who's going to vote, who got automatically registered to vote when they got their driver's license, you know. The Republicans are just all over this. But election fraud, the systematic theft of election, one in five voters in the state of Colorado being thrown off the polls by the Republican Secretary of State, that the Democrats are afraid if they talk about it will cause people not to vote. I think it's wrong. I think they're wrong. I think their strategic decision is wrong. They made this decision back before the 2004 election. And this is why John Kerry never talked about it. Frankly, I doubt Barack Obama will talk about it. I think it's a mistake, but, you know, they're in the political business. I'm just on the outside looking in. Maybe they're right. I don't know, but I don't think so. And I think you're right, but I don't suspect it's going to happen. Catherine in Ann Arbor. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to give a quick shout out concerning your poll worker story that I read in the Ann Arbor News this Sunday. That my county has more poll workers than they need for the first time ever.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, but because I was looking into it myself. Mm. But what I wanted to ask you was that, and I've been meaning to ask you this for a while, we have a certain segment of the population that are absolutely terrified of the fact that Barack Obama might actually become our president. And God willing, if
you mean
because
he's half black, half white?
If he is our president, we're going to have 30 to 40% of our fellow Americans totally terrified. And I don't know what we can do to help them. They're going to be afraid of the changes that are going to need to occur. And, the right wing is going to whip that fear frenzy up.
Yeah, Catherine, I think we just need to completely recalibrate that. It's, you know, I get it. And in fact, that's one of the major Republican memes that's out there is be afraid, be very afraid. First of all, I don't think it's 20 or 30% of people who are I don't even think afraid is the right word. I don't think that there's a lot of the only people who are appropriately afraid of Barack Obama being elected are the members of the Bush administration who have committed crimes, people like Karl Rove. He damn well better be afraid that Barack Obama gets elected. And that's why they're committing crimes to cover up their crimes right now, as Greg Palast was just talking about. But, you know, there are people who are, particularly people I'd say probably over 50, over 60, who are reluctant, white people who are reluctant to vote for a guy who's half African-American. And, you know, I think that that's a tragedy. I'm not sure what we can say about that. I think what Barack Obama is doing is addressing that issue by being himself, by talking about the issues, by behaving presidentially. And it's just like John Kennedy didn't go around and in every speech say, oh, by the way, I'm a Catholic, but don't be afraid. Because he wasn't the first Catholic nominee. I think that was Al Smith. He was the first Catholic president. And, you know, it was a pretty radical thing, right? But, I just think that Obama is going to deal with that just straight on by just being himself. I'm not really worried about it. Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike.
Hi. I'd like to say a couple things in defense of Sarah Palin. First, if we want to encourage more people to participate in politics and run for office, we shouldn't get down on Sarah for using public office for personal revenge. And second, I think she's right that John McCain really is a maverick because he's an older model without a computer that was sporty 40 years ago.
Uh-huh.
His timing's off, so he lurches. He's poor on fuel economy, and he doesn't run well on a cross-country trip.
Oh, sort of like a Ford Maverick?
Yeah.
it's an old car. Okay, good. Good one, Mike. Thank you very much. That's a little levity. Sure. Lewis in Portland. Hey, Lewis.
Good morning, Tom. Hey, the solution to this purging is very simple. You can call, as a candidate, you can call and pay for a list of all the purged voters, and your phone banks can call these people. And if there's one single representative that's within the sound of my voice or your voice, and they don't do this, they deserve to lose. These are simple tactics to overcome. I'm on a phone bank, 2 days a week, pardon me, every other week, and we call people who are registered Democrats, call people who are registered independents, and they have a list in front of me of, hey, Mr. Voter, did you know that your Secretary of State purged you from the rolls? I think that particular voter might get a little bit mad and might cement his vote for our candidate.
That's interesting. Okay, thank you, Lewis. I didn't realize it was that easy to get those lists. It may be here in Oregon because we've got a great Secretary of State, Bill Bradbury, just a fine and one of the most honorable men in politics I've ever met in my life. I know the guy, and just a great man. But I wonder in Colorado if you were to try to get a copy of the Purge list. Well, if any of our listeners in Colorado try it, contact your Secretary of State and see if you can get a copy of that Purge list and let us know what happens. Kathy in Peru, Illinois. Hey, Kathy.
Oh, hi, Tom. Have you heard of a Republican honcho by the name of Bob Schillender?
Not that I can say I have any familiarity with.
Okay. No. Well, in the Chicago Tribune, in John Cass's column this March, they mentioned Big Bob Schillender, and John Cass puts a dollar sign through his name, through the S. It starts with the K. Well, anyhow, he's got more connections to Tony Resco than Senator Obama does.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear these days that Obama's connections to Resco were pretty much the other way around. Resco is trying to establish connections with Obama, and it's why he bought the lot next to his house. And that, there's basically no there. But there's a lot of politicians in Chicago who are quaking in their boots. The sentencing of Resco has been postponed indefinitely, which is typically what happens when somebody's singing. So, we'll see where this is going to go. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim.
Hi, Tom. Hey, you mentioned earlier the effects of television on us, and I've been trying to analyze why I haven't taken to the streets over. Like, the bailout just outraged me, to be honest with you. And, frankly, we could have organized across the party affiliation over that because so many of us felt it was just wrongheaded. And we could have demanded that the politicians address their grievances, but nobody was in the streets over this like the people were in the 60s.
I think people weren't in the streets over the bailout because they didn't understand it. You had a lot of fairly reasonable, incredible people agreeing, like Barack Obama, agreeing with George Bush that there was something scary here going on. My personal take on it is that it was a rush to judgment, a rush to act in a way that probably is going to...
I agree.
Be more harmful ultimately than helpful. But it's what was done before. Basically this is the same thing Herbert Hoover tried in 1931.
It didn't work then.
Yeah, no, it didn't work then. It made the situation worse, and it's the same thing now. But I think that most Americans just, it just flew right over the top of their heads. Missed the radar screen altogether, whatever, bad cliche you want to toss in here. And that's the problem. I suspect if this election is stolen, like 2000 was stolen and 2004 were stolen, that there are going to be many more people out in the streets, hopefully peacefully.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Now you got to work at democracy. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here back with you 9.5 minutes before the hour. Whoa! He's at it again. A small-time crook and entrepreneur from Italy who saw a couple decades ago bought a radio station, then bought a TV station, then bought another radio station, then bought a newspaper, then bought another radio station, then bought a radio network, then bought a TV network, then bought a couple more TV stations, then bought a couple more newspapers, They bought another radio network, ended up owning all the independent radio networks, all the independent TV networks, and most of the newspapers in the country. And then what did he do? Silvio Berlusconi ran for prime minister. And guess what? Surprise! He won! Well, he's now 72 years old. And this story. Milan chief Silvio Berlusconi has shown that he's still young at heart despite being 72 as he went clubbing over the weekend to spot the young talent on show and came away with one. The Italian president was seen leaving the Lotus nightclub in Milan with a young lady and was quickly met by the waiting press pack. Rather than speeding off with his bodyguards, he decided to stay back and explain the situation, perhaps delighted with the talent he picked up on the night. It's unlikely that they will be playing for Milan. In other words, it wasn't a football player, a soccer player. He says, I only sleep three... This is what he told the press. I only sleep 3 hours. The others are to make love. I hope you people reach 70 years of age in the form I am in. I always have plenty to learn from youngsters. A Berlusconi alert for the day. I guess if you're going to have an oligarch, if you're going to have a guy who basically owns all the media and then runs the country, at least, you know, the Italians have got a colorful one. There's something to be said for it. Anthony in Anaheim. Hey, Anthony. What's on your mind today? Anthony, you're on the air. Okay, John in Los Angeles. You're on the air, John.
Well, I'm younger than Silvio, so I'll just say, Silvio, learn this.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, I just wanted to say that to everybody that you know, if you it may be perverted what I'm about to say, but fear and change seem to be going together, and there's a lot of change going on nowadays.
Well, there's a lot of people. The Republican Party is trying to spread this mantra that change is something that should be associated with fear, and I discard that. Americans have always embraced change. We're the can-do nation.
Well, let me tell you, Tom, if I may, I personally was always afraid of change. I was afraid of changing my assumptions, afraid of changing jobs, things like that. Okay, so it's part of me.
You know, in a way, John, maybe this needs to be reframed because, in a way, maybe this needs to be reframed because what has happened is over the last 26 years, America has been changed by these conservatives who have basically destroyed our government and destroyed our country. And the change that Obama is talking about in large part is taking back America, is putting us back the way we used to be.
Well, if you want to choose not to be afraid, that's a choice that everyone has to make. But one of the things that's come up in terms of martial law that was threatened during this vote for the bailout bill,
right,
and martial law that's being discussed and done now with this army regiment, whatever, being repositioned, I think that it should be seen that this situation needs to be diffused, this threat.
No,
whether it's the threat from the anarchists or the threat from the martialists, it needs to be diffused by some legislation, legal means, legislation that withdraws this bailout. And even if it doesn't pass, it needs to be put forth
I'm sorry, Victoria Jones is with us and I need to get to that, but I agree with you, A, and B, it ain't going to happen because Congress is going into, you know, they're going into recess and you know, frankly, you know, Posse Comitatus was put back at law and George Bush issues a signing statement saying he doesn't recognize it. We already have that's the law that says the U.S. Army can't turn their guns on American citizens, but we'll discuss that in a little bit. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. On the line with us. What's happening in Washington, D.C., Victoria?
Well, Dana Perino went to great lengths today to avoid using the word recession when she was being asked about the economy, even though she made the point that the next quarter's numbers are going to be very bad. But she won't use the word recession. Apparently, she doesn't want to worry the American people.
Well, I think it's more Bush does not want his legacy to be right up there with Herbert Hoover.
Very likely. Perhaps he doesn't need to worry about who he's going to be up there with. It's other people worrying after him whether they're going to be up there with him.
Yeah, I mean, the Dow is down 325 points right now. We've got another day that it's disintegrating. This is just so the logical consequence of 26 years of conservative ideology. And anyhow, so what else is up?
Well, so that's the main thing that's up, because all of that really is taking a backseat to the debate tonight, which people are saying favors McCain, but in many ways it doesn't, because it's not a traditional town hall meeting where he gets to have back and forth with the audience. He doesn't get to have back and forth with the audience.
This is, you know, this is really kind of a phony town hall meeting, because you get 500 people submitting questions, and then Tom Brokaw gets to go through them and pick out the ones he likes and perhaps rewrite them so they're a little more literate, or they say exactly what he would want said. And really, ultimately, the bottom line here is that Tom Brokaw is deciding what the topics are going to be. Tom Brokaw, the guy who a week and a half ago wrapped up the segment on Meet the Press, where you had Steve Schmidt and David Axelrod on, by saying, well, the polls show that more Americans want John McCain as commander-in-chief.
So it's going to be really fair and balanced then.
Yeah, right. In your dreams. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great to hear your voice. And thanks for checking in with us. Dr. Marjorie Cohn, president of the National Lawyers Guild, is going to be with us right after this break. Stick around. What's a McCain administration going to look like?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Marjorie Cohn is the president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she teaches criminal law and procedure, evidence, and international human rights law. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent, and the author of several other brilliant books in the past. Marjorie Cohn, CoHn.com, MarjorieCohn.com, her website. Dr. Cohn, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure, Tom.
You have written a chilling op-ed piece here, A Palin Theocracy, in which you basically lay out what is right there in front. It's hidden in plain sight, which is the kind of an administration that Sarah Palin would run if she were president, or that she would help bring to a McCain presidency if he were to survive throughout his first 4 years or even 8 years.
That's true. Now, remember, about a year ago, McCain said, quote, "the Constitution established the United States of America as a Christian nation," unquote. The founding fathers were not Christians, most of them. They were deists. They did not put anything about Christianity into the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And so McCain and Palin fit very nicely together, because Palin is a right-wing, radical, fundamentalist Christian who would love to create a theocracy. When she, as governor of Alaska, she asked her congregation to pray for the natural gas pipeline. She called it God's will. She asked them to pray that the war in Iraq is a task that is from God. She pushed for creationism to be taught in schools. She opposes stem cell research. And certainly she opposes abortion rights, reproductive rights. She made the choice to continue her pregnancy with the Down syndrome child. Her daughter made the choice to continue with her teenage pregnancy. And yet Palin would deny a woman who was victimized by rape or incest the right to a choice of abortion. And then Palin would criminally punish both the woman for having the abortion and the doctor for performing it. So she believes in that we're living in end times, which means that when Jesus comes back, there'll be a bloody inferno and only true Christians will be saved. And I think a lot of I don't know that she has strong support among the Jewish community, but the Jews who do support her, because they, I think, wrongfully perceive that she is more sympathetic to Israel than Barack Obama, she and McCain, don't understand that when this end times happens, the Christians' intent is either to convert the Jews to Christianity or kill them. Her Wasilla Bible Church is run by a guy who runs Jews for Jesus. And even the Anti-Defamation League called the Jews for Jesus, talked about its aggressive and deceptive proselytizing of Jews. So, I mean, we are in for real trouble, in my opinion, if McCain becomes president. And keep in mind that McCain is not in good health. His medical file, assuming that all of it was released to the public, the pages were not numbered, was nearly 1,200 pages long. I think Barack Obama's was one page long. And McCain is not in good health. And so Palin would literally be a heartbeat away from the presidency, and this is what we're facing, aside from the fact that she has no idea at all about the issues, and doesn't evidently read anything and doesn't evidently know of any Supreme Court cases except for Roe v. Wade. It's very, very frightening.
One of the things that concerns me the most is that We have seen over the last 8 years what happens when you have a president and vice president, neither of whom have any training at law. They both have master's degrees in business administration. And, you know, if you don't understand the law, and John McCain has no training at law, and in fact he graduated basically at the bottom of his class from Annapolis, and Sarah Palin, you know, bounced around five or six different colleges, flunked out of one, made it back up at a junior college and whatnot, and got a degree that qualified her to be a sportscaster. And, you know, and for them to be going on about the founders, I mean, when Thomas Jefferson wrote the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, he wrote, you know, it's when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them. John Adams, who was I believe, Presbyterian, he was a Christian. John Adams scratched out nature's God and replaced it with Christian God. And Thomas Jefferson scratched that back out and said, no, it's nature's God. You know, there were a few radical Christians among the founders. Patrick Henry, for example, his famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death was about wanting to have a theocracy in the United States. But you're absolutely right. The majority were deists or simply didn't, you know, address the issue, like George Washington, who never proclaimed anything, and a few Unitarians in there. And this was established as a secular nation, as a nation that tolerates religion, that allows or even celebrates religion, but does not have any official religion. And here we have, Palin and McCain both saying that this is a Christian nation, and talking about things that, you know, passing laws based on biblical, their interpretation, and relatively recent interpretations, I would say, by the way. This whole end time scenario that has been laid out and was popularized in the 1970s with the late great Planet Earth, that book and now with the Left Behind series, really originated in the 19th century. I mean, it's a recent thing for Christianity. And this is downright scary stuff, Marjorie Cohen.
It is indeed, Tom, and not only don't they have any training in law, but they have no intellectual curiosity. The fact that Palin could not name one book or magazine that she reads, and certainly she reads the Bible, but I think that she wants to stay away from that. She's savvy enough to know that she should not be wearing her religion on her sleeve during this campaign or it's going to hurt her and John McCain. But no curiosity. I don't see it from McCain either. I don't see him delving into books or ideas. And Bush and Cheney certainly had no intellectual curiosity. Clinton did. And, you know, although I am critical of some of the things that Clinton did during his administration, at least he had some kind of historical grounding. He had, he was a reader, and I don't see this at all. I think one thing that I would like to discuss, and something that unfortunately, Obama is not hammering on, and I don't know quite why, although maybe in the polling it didn't seem like a big issue, but if that's the case, it hasn't been explained well, and that is, even if people are critical of Obama's foreign policy and Obama's vote for FISA and other things, you know, many on the left are critical of. The bottom line is that in an Obama administration, there would be a very different appointments of Supreme Court justices and federal court justices than there would in a McCain administration. And what it would mean if, first of all, it's very, very likely that there will be one or more appointments because there are people in bad health, elderly, who want to retire, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, all on the left, so-called on the left, which means that if McCain replaced any of them, he would tip the balance radically to the right, whereas if Obama replaced any of them, he would maintain the status quo, which is a very delicate balance. And what would happen is that McCain, with even one appointment, would overturn, would give the fifth vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, which would mean that we would be back to the back alley coat hanger abortions. Several of the very close 5-4 decisions would be reconsidered, such as decisions preventing criminal punishment of private consensual homosexual behavior, stopping the death penalty for crimes committed by juveniles or mentally retarded people, ensuring the availability of habeas corpus for the Guantanamo detainees, allowing colleges and universities to consider race to achieve diversity in student admissions. And this is not just the Supreme Court. Over 58% of all federal judges, and that includes circuit court judges, were appointed by Republican presidents. Bush has appointed nearly 37% of them, and we're talking about lifetime appointments, and federal court judges have eroded the right to privacy. They've approved pay discrimination. They've insulated large corporations from liability for harm caused to Americans, prohibited communities from using the democratic process to ensure racially diverse schools, et cetera. So really, one of the biggest things that is at stake in this election, in my opinion, is the future of the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary, and it's really incumbent upon Obama to explain to people in very simple terms what it would mean if McCain appointed even one justice to the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade would be overturned, and we'd be back to coat hanger abortions, and people need to talk about this.
Yeah, well said. Dr. Marjorie Cohn, her website, marjoriecohn.com, and her new book, it will be coming out, Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. Dr. Cohn, thanks so much for dropping by.
My pleasure, Tom.
It is always, always enlightening to talk with you. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our phone number.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active. Well, the Dow down 210 points right now. Yeah, that bailout really, really helped a lot, didn't it? Brad Sherman, Congressman Brad Sherman from the 27th District of California, was on the floor of the House a couple of days ago and said something that perked up a whole lot of ears. This is the clip.
The only way they can pass this bill is by creating and sustaining a panic atmosphere. That atmosphere is not justified. Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no.
Congressman Brad Sherman, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Astounded. You know, martial law in America?
Well, they were getting really silly in painting the doomsday if we didn't pass the bill. And I was contrasting that with what actually happened. They claim over a 700-point drop in the market followed our voting down the bill, but about a third of that drop occurred the first 15 minutes of Friday morning at a time when everybody thought we were going to pass the bill.
Right.
So the fact is, voting down the bill had such a limited effect on this country, apparently. Of course, voting for the bill has been followed by the greatest decline in the market in my lifetime.
Yeah, in fact, one of the comments that's been made is in the Asian press was that this bailout bill was like dropping a pebble into the ocean. It is, in my humble opinion, the wrong remedy at the wrong time, done the wrong way by the wrong people.
No, it wasn't a pebble. I mean, this is $700 billion. We
right.
dropped it in the wrong pond, and now we have $700 billion less to really craft something to deal with the situation. The bill was not tailored to deal with the economy. It was tailored to bail out certain firms on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs. And
right. And now the guy who's going to be administering the $700 billion is the former protege of Mr. Paulson, Goldman Sachs.
Well,
and,
yeah, I mean, you know.
And the Democrats who were pushing this were like Robert Rubin, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I mean, Goldman's $500 million and more is what Paulson took from Goldman Sachs as in his last couple of years. Now somebody else from Goldman Sachs reporting to Paulson from Goldman Sachs. The program's administered in an absurd way. All the power is vested in Paulson, who is part-time temporary.
Right. And, well, you could argue, actually, that the power...
What?
You could argue, actually, that the power is vested in George W. Bush, because Paulson serves at his pleasure, and
right.
so... Which astounded me that nobody pointed out that what they were really voting to do was give $700 billion to George Bush, who would have Paulson administer it.
I pointed that out many times when I said that this is the greatest transfer of power to an imperial presidency ever.
Yeah. Yeah,
and also the greatest transfer of wealth to a still wealthy Wall Street.
Right. In my opinion, this is the Bush administration. You know, they made jokes about when the Clinton administration left that people stole China, and it turned out it wasn't the case. This is as they're leaving on the way out the door. They're not just stealing the China and the silver. They're stripping. They're opening up the walls and taking the copper wiring out. You know.
Well, they want to make sure their friends are taken care of, and they can't count on retaining the presidency.
But back to the discussion of martial law. That's now the posse comitatus, according to George Bush, no longer exists. One of his last signing statements, you know, when posse comitatus was put back into law, he said he didn't recognize it. He's now brought back one of the combat brigades into the United States for riot control and crowd control at post-election. And a lot of people are very concerned about this. The Army Times reporting that they would be doing duty inside the United States, facing American citizens. This is the most bloodied of all the combat divisions in the U.S. Army. What's the story here?
I know that people have focused on my comments where I said a few people were mentioning martial law. I did not take those threats, or I won't say threats, that doomsday scenario seriously then. Even now that things are worse, perhaps because we passed the bailout bill, I don't take those threats seriously.
Yeah.
But
Was it the Bush administration saying this?
This was more member-to-member conversations where one member would say it's going to drop 1,000 points, 2,000 points, oh, it's going to drop 3,000. Well, if that happens, then I do not... I do think that the president deliberately created an economic panic, and this is the first time a president has created panic in order to pass legislation, and it was effective.
Yeah.
And so now we have some bad legislation.
Yeah, well said. Congressman Brad Sherman, thanks for standing up for this.
Thank you.
And thanks for standing up for the 27th District of California. You're doing a great job. Congressman Brad Sherman with us. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your calls on the other end of this break. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. You can drop into our live chat room over at tomhartman.com, airamerica.com for our video. Free. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the support, the democracy support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program. Lionel Beaner is blogging over at Huffington Post. This is a really thought-provoking post. It's called The Case for Not Going Negative. And he's been out canvassing, going door to door in Philadelphia, outside of Philadelphia. And he met a whole lot of people who basically said, I'm not going to go to vote. I'm just not going to show up. Why? Because they're both sides are slinging mud. And his suggestion is that Obama should stay positive, should be positive and stay positive, and that Kerry didn't lose. He doesn't address the fact that Ohio was stolen, but nonetheless, that Kerry didn't lose because of the Swift voters. He lost because he had the personality of a thimble. And I think, actually, you could probably make a pretty good case for that. 866-303-2270, Judy in Windup, Michigan. Hey, Judy.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Thank you for taking my call. Hello?
What's up? Yes, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I couldn't agree more with what you just said about staying positive. In fact, that was the point of my call. Here in Wyandotte, we've done some very grassroots organizing to get our own Obama office opened, completely staffed by volunteers, completely done by donations. And we've been having a great response. And I believe that staying on message and staying positive is helping the cause greatly.
Yeah, I agree. And earlier in the program I said, I hope Obama comes out with some of this point or that point. And now I'm reconsidering. I think that his strategy up to this point that he successfully used against the other Democratic nominees, including Senator Clinton, who is a formidable opponent, and that he has used so far against John McCain successfully, is to just be relentlessly positive. I think it's a great strategy. I think it's going to work.
Right. I know, especially here in Michigan, people are not going to vote for John McCain because Sarah Palin is trying to tie Obama to a terrorist. They want to vote for somebody who's going to bring back the jobs. And that's all we need to keep telling people, is that Barack Obama has a plan to do that. He supports manufacturing in the United States. He supports not giving tax breaks to companies that send jobs overseas. And the more people hear that, the more it sinks in. Because in Michigan, we're dying here. It's every house has foreclosed homes. There's plants closing all over the place. It's,
no, I know it well. My family's all from Michigan, and I get back there several times a year.
If I could just make one more point, please. Anybody listening, your listeners are all on the same page. Go to your local Obama office. If you can give an hour. I have three kids. I have a very hectic, crazy life. I have given every extra hour that I can. Make some phone calls. Knock on some doors. Voter contact is imperative in this election. It works. The campaign has research on it. It works. To talk to people.
And on election day, if you can't volunteer to be a poll worker, you can volunteer to drive people to the polls or help out in a whole wide variety of ways.
Absolutely.
Judy, got to move along. But thank you so much for your comments. It's great. Philip in Boca Raton, Florida. Hey, Philip.
Hello. Well, Tom, thank you for taking my call. I think one of the hidden agendas why this bailout bill occurred, as strange as it seems, was to protect the primary broker-dealers. Our debt is so massive. The primary broker-dealers are the mechanism for us to sell bonds in the foreign market. We didn't have that mechanism. We could never finance this massive, massive debt. I think part of the reason we have this massive, massive debt is because we have no industrial base anymore, no manufacturing base. We don't make any.
You're singing my song, Philip. I mean, that's the essence of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, is that not only have we destroyed our industrial base, we don't make anything here anymore, but that it was done by design, that the middle class is being destroyed by design because conservatives back in the 60s and 70s looked at, kids smoking pot and having free love and African Americans protesting and rioting in some of the cities in Detroit and Oakland and whatnot, and they said, holy cow, this is a society in meltdown. This is what happens when you have a middle class that is too healthy economically. We need to have a little more poverty, a little more fear to stabilize our society. And that, by the way, is the same thing that conservatives were saying in the 1760s, those conservatives who opposed the American Revolution. And they saw the American Revolution as a sign of decay in this country. And so, we've had these two periods of a strong middle class, the 1770s and the 1970s, and both of those periods produced social unrest. And people like Thomas Jefferson looked at that social unrest and said, this is a great thing! And, yeah. and people like John Adams looked at that social unrest, well, actually John Adams is a bad example, but in the modern day, people like Barry Goldwater looked at that social unrest and said, this is terrible, we've got to stop it. Or Ronald Reagan canceled, you know, did away with free education, free college at the University of California system. And when he asked why, he said, because why should I pay the tuition for kids to go to school who are then going to go out and protest me and my policies?
Two points, if I may. Okay, the first point, I'm sorry, to establish this industrial base, I think Robbie Batra is absolutely right. We're going to have to get rid of this notion of free trade and go back to fair trade. So we impose tariffs again.
Right.
I think that's right. To protect our industry until we get back on our
feet. As every other country in the world does that has any kind of a rational trade policy. Korea uses tariffs. China uses tariffs. Japan uses tariffs. France uses tariffs. I mean, it's...
Now, one other embarrassing question, if I may, and then I'm going to let you. I know you're very busy. I looked at Obama, and they're out there suggesting that they're for middle classes. Yet I have this terrible problem. Biden, the big supporter of the bankruptcy bill. I realize MBNA is in his home state, and he's a... major campaign contributor. I realize that his son worked for MBNA as a lobbyist, but still, why the support of a man who took the ability for middle class people to go bankrupt? And you know, the primary source of bankruptcy was medical. You had a medical
disease. Philip, it was a terrible piece of legislation, and there are a number of very good politicians. You know, Debbie Stabenow, senator from Michigan. Darlene Hooley, the congresswoman who represents me, who voted for this, and I think it was a terrible mistake on their part, and I strongly oppose it. But I'm not willing to throw out Joe Biden just because he voted for the bankruptcy bill. And I'm very hopeful that if these guys are elected, that they can change this stuff around. Wendy in Portland. Hey, Wendy.
Hi. I wanted to talk with you about a comment that Ms. Cohen made earlier.
Right.
I was a little concerned that it was going to send some people into freak out because she made the comment that, if I understood her right, that some of the fundamentalist Christians believe that at the end times they were going to get out there and kill off the Jewish people. And
they believe that the Jewish people will be killed off either by fire from heaven or by the battles that are raging, as it were. Read Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth, that really started this stuff in the modern era back in 1972.
Yeah, I read that years ago.
Yeah, I did too. And you know, there'll be 144,000 people who survive in Jerusalem or who survive in Israel, and they will all convert to Christianity.
Yeah, I just was concerned that I did mishear it then. I was concerned that somebody was going to run around and think that there are a bunch of nutty Christians wanting to kill off Jewish people, and that's not.
Trust me, Wendy. No, there are a bunch of nutty Christians who believe that that's the way to go. And although that's not the theology that Sarah Palin is preaching.
No, I think I think they're called the KKK. And
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I just wanted to one other little point I wanted to make was I'm a strange mix, I guess. I'm a fundamentalist Christian, but I'm also consider myself to be left-wing and have been so certainly since I had to live in California under Ronald Reagan as governor. I think there's a tendency to be a little us and them between Christians and people who are not Christians in this particular election, and that concerns me. I think we need to be united in what we're trying to do here, because and Palin may be a Christian. I don't know if she is. I think that's been actually I feel like I've been manipulated by the Bush administration early on, or at least they attempted to. I think that a lot of what's been going on is because we've had people in office who are just idiots.
You know, Jesus told us by their fruits you shall know them.
Yeah.
Right? And here
right.
All you have to do, you look at Bush and what are the fruits of Bush? Poverty, despair, the death of a million people. You know, by his fruits, I cannot say that George Bush has been behaving in any way that be remotely called Christian.
That's
Wendy, I've got to move along, but thank you very much for your comments and you know, well said. Let's see. Avi in Irvine, California. Got about a minute before the break, Avi.
Yes,
what's up?
I'm American Israeli.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening nowadays with the calls of traitor and for Obama, the rallies reminds me of the days before Rabin's assassination, 1996 in Israel.
Mm.
There were opposition rallies where people at the crowds were called for Rabin's assassination with total quiescence from Netanyahu and other people who addressed the rallies, and it scares the hell out of me for Obama's safety and for the future of this nation, and it just is such a parallel.
Yeah, I'll give you another parallel. In Dallas, in the second week of November 1963 in Dallas, the local right-wingers bought a large ad in the Dallas major newspaper, draped in black, basically not calling for the assassination of Kennedy, but just, you know, this. There was a subtext to it that was not that different. And it's just, you know, yeah, I think that this is terrible. Avi, thank you very much for the call. Here we have two different campaign rallies yesterday where the nominee, the Democratic nominee for the President of the United States, or people associated with him, where there were calls for their death or calling them terrorists. And the Secret Service is not investigating?
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Back to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. 9.5 minutes, but it doesn't lead to stiff thinking. Not that we're 9.5 minutes before the hour. Every week we try to highlight or feature a success story of an advertiser in Progressive Talk Radio in the hopes not only that you'll support our advertisers, which is how we keep, you know, this show and all of the Progressive programming on the air and alive, but also that if you run a business and you want to reach an audience of really involved, really engaged, basically a great demographic, a generally upscale audience, this is the place to do it. Contact your local radio station. Contact the radio station you're listening to right now and ask them what they charge for advertising. You may be very surprised. Radio advertising is the most affordable way to reach people in today's environment. And, well, actually, and for a long time it has been. And so anyhow, every week we feature one of our advertisers. We give them 1 minute to pitch their product and 1 minute to tell about their success, and then we get back to your phone calls. This week, Roger Mason is with us. He's a research chemist who formulated a product called Beta Prostate that you've heard me pitch on this show. And Roger, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Tell us about Beta Prostate.
You know, any man over 40 should be taking this, Tom. Half of the men in this country over 50 already have a prostate issue. It's an epidemic. The classic sign is getting up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, and that's not a normal part of aging at all. The prostate is, in fact, a sexual organ. It can be a major cause of sexual dysfunction, and one-third of American men have some kind of sexual performance issue. Ignoring all this will just make it worse because it's not going to get any better.
Yeah, and Beta Prostate doesn't require a prescription and actually works.
This all is, natural, this, you know, found in every vegetable you eat.
Yeah, and there's a substantial body of evidence that this is good. Both many of the compounds in here, zinc in particular, beta testosterol, if I'm pronouncing it right, that these things not only are preventative but also restorative. If I'm using the correct language,
that's correct.
You're the research chemist. So Roger, tell us what we're talking with Roger Mason, the product Beta Prostate, the website betaprostate.com, and of course there's an 800 number associated with it that you'll have to listen to our spots to get. I don't have it written in.
Well, I have it.
Okay. What is it?
Okay. If they'll call 800-954-0803, that's 800-954-0803. 800-800-0803. If you buy two bottles, we'll give you a bottle free, plus my free book, The Natural Prostate Cure. It's completely guaranteed or your money back.
There you go. And real quickly, Roger, how has advertising on Progressive Talk Radio worked for you?
Oh, listen, advertising on progressive talk shows like yours is just great. So many thousands of men have bought Beta Prostate, changed their lives, because listeners like yours are responsive to vital issues like this. They're educated. They think for themselves. They reach out to a better audience. And we've worked well with you, and I want to thank you for that, because this has worked.
Well, thank you, Roger, and thanks for making a great product. I use it, and I recommend it.
Good.
So, Roger Mason, betaprostate.com. Thank you, Roger. Good talking with you, and thanks for supporting Progressive Talk Radio. 866-303-2270. Greg in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is maybe a little bit naive, but I'm willing to toss it out there into the public square. I know with your background going all the way back to the 60s with activism, you can probably address or critique this idea. I would like to suggest that Wednesday, November 5th, become known as Orange Wednesday.
It's a Tuesday.
The
5th. Yeah, the 4th.
Wednesday.
Yeah, okay.
November the 5th.
Right, okay.
And you can look at orange as a caution color, or we could take inspiration from the Ukrainians.
Yeah.
So I'd like to take your comments off the air.
Okay. Well, basically, what are you suggesting, that we be out in the streets celebrating a victory or protesting a defeat or an election theft or something like that? Is that what that?
Well, look at it this way. If we've got one Ohio, we've got 49 other states that can help out.
Yeah.
If something goes wrong in Florida, we should probably, I would suspect, know it by, say, noon or local time the next day.
I think there's so much early voting now going on around the country that we're going to start hearing these stories fairly soon as people show up at the polls, you know, for early voting and try to vote. And this is why Greg Palast says don't do it through the mail, you know, other than in Oregon where it's the only way to vote. But actually physically show up so that you can find out if you've been purged. But Greg, good point. Thank you very much. We'll see how this shakes out. We're just going to have to watch this one. Mark in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was listening. A friend of mine was listening yesterday, and y'all had a discussion on taxpayer taxes on healthcare benefits.
Right.
And I was listening to Biden and the debate, and he was talking about this will be the first time ever in history this has taken place. And on the commercials on their TV spots, this is a big thing that they're saying that McCain's going to do to us. Well, I currently have a domestic partner, and we receive benefits through my employer. Those are already taxed.
Actually, they're not. Your employer, and speaking as an employer, I can tell you, employers can deduct the cost of health insurance as a cost of doing business, and you deduct it before you calculate profits. You don't pay taxes on it.
No, I am paying taxes on it.
Oh, if you're personally paying for health insurance, you're right.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the simple solution to that is not to tax employer benefits like McCain is suggesting, but to allow individuals who are buying their own benefits, their own health care insurance, to deduct that from their income taxes as well.
My employer provides health care to my domestic partner.
Okay.
Health care benefits.
Then how are you having to pay taxes on it?
The amount of money that my employer pays, the premium that my employer pays on that health care, which is $282 every 2 weeks for me.
Mark, I'm sorry. We're just flat out of time. Bottom line, your employer can deduct that from their taxes. If they're recovering it from you, then maybe you can't. But in any case, coming up tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey will be here. Of course, we're listening to the debate tonight. We'll keep you up to date. Matt Stein going to drop by. Don't forget, my friends, democracy depends on you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.